hope everyone had a wonderful Yom Tov, a true Zman of Simchatenu. Are we ready? Okay. And, you know, in Eretz Yisrael, the Chagim are always a very big part of the year. So sometimes when you need to get things done, they can't do it because before the Chagim, they can't do it because it's the middle of the Chagim, and they can't do it because it's right after the Chagim. So there's a lot of delays. But hopefully, Bezras Hashem, the Chagim have inspired us, and we are ready to enter the regular year with a great deal of enthusiasm. We will, in Mitzvah Hashem, get back to Mishlei next week. Today, though, since we are in the afterglow of the Chagim, I want to talk about the 1 month of the year that is coming up that seems not to have any holidays at all, and that is, of course, the month of Cheshvan. And there is a folk etymology that the reason why the month is called Mar Cheshvan is connected to the notion of bitterness, because it is the only Chodesh that does not have a Yom Tov. Now, in truth, that is what I call a folk etymology, because in reality, there are many other reasons why Mar Cheshvan. One reason is that Mar is connected to raindrops, and Cheshvan is the beginning of the rainy season, although we did have some rain during Sukkot, which is not always the best type of simen. Others point out that the Gemara itself tells us that the names of the Jewish months come from Babylon. They are Babylonian names in origin. And Mar Cheshvan was actually something similar to that, was the Babylonian name. But nevertheless, it is a common idea that's expressed that Cheshvan is the 1 month without Yomim Tovim. Now, let's go over the calendar very quickly to see if Cheshvan is indeed the only one. All right, so Tishrei, of course, has many. Kislev has Chanukah. Teves has the end of Chanukah, because Chanukah always goes into Teves. Shvat has Tu B'Shvat. All right, so you're stretching the definition of Yom Tov. Adar, of course, has Purim. Nisan has Pesach. What does Iyar have? Well, Iyar has Lag Ba'Omer. Iyar has Pesach Sheni. And if you are at Sioni, Iyar has Yom Ha'atzma'ut, which many will also consider to be a Chag. Okay, then we have Sivan, which is Shavuos. Then we have Tammuz. Now, Tammuz is a hard one. Tammuz also, the only notable date that we have in Tammuz is the 17th of Tammuz, which is a fast day commemorating the breaking into Yerushalayim at the time of the Chorban Bayit Sheni. But still, we treat that as a Yom Tov, actually, because it is said that when Mashiach comes, all of the fast days shall in fact become festive, joyous days. So potentially, the 17th of Tammuz will become a Chag, and the same thing is true for Av, where the 9th of Av will be the day that Mashiach is born, and of course, the 15th of Av was considered to be the happiest, most joyous day of the Jewish calendar. We then come to Elul. Now, Elul seems to be parallel to Cheshvan a little bit, in which Elul does not have any particular Yomim Tovim, but still, all of Elul, in a sense, is one big Yom Tov, because from Rosh Chodesh Elul through Yom Kippur are called Yemei Ratzon. They are days of grace, days in which Hashem has much, much rachamim, and therefore we treat that as a Yom Tov. But then comes lowly Cheshvan. So here, I want to share with you a little bit of a perspective on what the month of Cheshvan represents in the Jewish calendar. And let me start off with the comment of Rav Tzadok of Lublin. You know, the earliest Kabbalistic work that we have is not the Zohar. The earliest Kabbalistic work we have is a work called Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Creation. And some attribute the authorship of this book to Avraham Avinu, and some even attribute it to Adam HaRishon. And you can even get an English translation, even for free, although it wouldn't mean very much to us. Sefer Yetzirah basically describes the idea that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the universe, created heaven and earth and the whole universe, by combining in various ways the spiritual powers of the Aleph Beis. In fact, it's interesting. You know, we read in yesterday's Parsha that all the animals passed before Adam, And Adam gave the animals names, right? Adam named the animals. So I remember reading an essay by Mark Twain. It was an unpublished essay. And Mark Twain was very sarcastic. Towards the end of his life, he was very embittered. He had lost his wife and lost a daughter. It was very, and the tragedies had really shaken him up. So as a result, he no longer believed in God, and he was often very, he would make fun of religion in many ways, but he wouldn't do it publicly. These are like unpublished writings. So in one of his unpublished essays, he has this conversation between Adam and Eve, in which Adam calls the lion a lion. He has it in English. And Eve, Chava, asks Adam, why did you call the lion a lion? Why did you call it that? He says, well, what do you mean? It looks exactly like a lion. So, of course, I called it a lion. What did you want me to call it? Now, the truth of the matter is, Mark Twain is actually mechaven to something very, very deep. Because the concept is, every single entity in the universe comes into its physical form by the combination of the particular letters of the alphabet. There's kind of a DNA. There's a spiritual koach in these letters. Adam HaRishon was like an MRI, or a very highly sophisticated CAT scan. Adam HaRishon looked into the Aryeh, and he said, I see that this Aryeh is a result of the combination of the kochos in this order, Aleph, Resh, Yud, Hey. So Mark Twain was right. He called it an Aryeh because its spiritual essence comes from the Tserufe Osios. Tserufe Osios means the combination of the letters which result in Aryeh. And that's why calling the animals what he called them was really a form of Nevuah, because essentially he was able to penetrate into the inner essence. In fact, the Ramban writes, this is why Hebrew is called Lashon, or at least, you know, Biblical Hebrew, is called Lashon HaKodesh. What is so Kodesh about Ivrit? So, okay, I'm not getting into modern Ivrit, but whatever, but, you know, the Lashon of the Torah is called Lashon HaKodesh. So there's a machlokes, the Rambam and the Ramban. The Rambam gives a fairly rational reason why Hebrew is called Lashon HaKodesh. Because there are no obscene or pornographic terms that are indigenous to Hebrew. That's why when an Israeli swears, he has to use Arabic, more or less. That Lashon HaKodesh, everything about functions that shouldn't be discussed, are the words that are used are euphemistic words. And therefore, since none of these functions is directly described, it has a certain level of kedusha. And as I say, that's why Hebrew profanity is really basically Arabic, or maybe Yiddish sometimes. Okay. Or English, yeah. Now, Ramban gives a more fundamental reason. Ramban says it's Lashon HaKodesh because all languages in the world are simply matters of arbitrary convention. The fact that in the English language, for example, a certain red fruit is called an apple, there's no intrinsic reason why it had to be an apple. You could have called it a pear, and you could have called a pear an apple. It would have been equally meaningful. It is simply an arbitrary group of symbols that people agree shall represent a certain thing. Lashon HaKodesh is very different. Lashon HaKodesh, the actual Hebrew term for something. Again, I'm not referring to Eliezer ben Yehuda's various inventions. That obviously is also kind of just decisions that were made, but I'm talking about the Lashon of Hebrew that the Torah uses, is not simply a convention. It represents the spiritual essence of something. An Aryeh is what you get when you combine the spiritual forces of Aleph, Resh, Yud, He in a certain order. A Kelev is what you get when you take the Chaf, the Lamed, and the Beis. Right? Just like even physical DNA is represented by sequences of letters, although that's just an arbitrary convention. So too, there is a spiritual DNA. So Sefer Yetzirah is the book that describes how the various combinations of letters give rise to different things. Now, the emesis, great tzaddikim, were able to use Sefer Yetzirah to create their own things. The Gemara tells us that there were tzaddikim every Erev Shabbos. They would use Sefer Yetzirah to create a calf that they would then shecht and be able to eat on Shabbos. The idea of the golem, all the different stories of the golem in which kind of a human-like creature is created, that comes from Sefer Yetzirah. Now, the most famous story of the golem is probably not true, but I don't want to say for sure, and that is the story of the Maharal creating a golem that was kind of like a Superman that would defend the Jews in Prague from various attacks. And legend has it that when the golem got decommissioned, it remained like a dead figure in the attic of the old Maharal Space Knesset in Prague, which is under lock and key. And stories have it that the Nazis went in and they immediately died because the golem got reactivated momentarily. But I will tell you that although I certainly am very happy to believe that the Maharal could have created a golem, in other words, I'm a maimon, I have emuna in the power of tzaddikim to do it, as a matter of historical fact, it's very, very unlikely. And that is simply for the following reason. The Maharal died in the 1500s. When the Maharal died, and the Maharal was a very well-known gadol, very mefursam, there was absolutely no mention of a golem. The very first mention of the Maharal and a golem was in the 1800s, more than 300 years after his death, by a rabbi who claimed to have discovered a long-lost manuscript that referred to the golem. And this rabbi, unfortunately, although he was a Talmud Chacham, had a very nasty habit of forging many, many documents. We know it from other documents that he would often forge things. And therefore, there's really no cheskas kashrus at all that this was a reliable account. And the fact that nobody mentions it for 350 years after the Maharal's death indicates that it probably was not true. Now, it is recorded in the biographies of the Vilna Gaon that when the Vilna Gaon was 13 years old, he was, you know, talk about kids playing with their chemistry sets. He was in the process of creating a golem. At 13 already, he had mastered all of the Kabbalah, but his father ordered him not to do it. His father said, these are too dangerous to fool around with. One should not get involved. Yeah. It doesn't really give it to you in such an accessible way, as it were. So you really cannot get a full understanding just by reading the Sefer Yetzirah. Now, there's all discussion. Yeah. We have what? Didn't hear. Well, that's right. That's right. That's a non-Kabbalistic. Yeah, but the difference was, you know, a robot is created through a mechanical process. This is through an incantation, through a spiritual process. Now, there is a whole discussion in halacha. If a person is created, not a person, not really a human, but if a human-like creation is made through Sefer Yetzirah, can you count them for a minion? Can you count a golem for a minion if a golem shows up? Although it's interesting, according to many, a golem cannot talk. It's very interesting because the talking comes from the divine soul within a human being, and a golem does not have a divine soul. That's why destroying a golem is not murder, because it does not have a divine soul. A golem, halakhically, is close to a robot, essentially. Although it was activated by Kabbalistic means, it does not have the status of a human being. We are also told it does not have internal organs. So if you were to take a knife and stick it into the golem, you would just get dirt or clay. You would not get, there's no heart there, there's no lung there. It's like the Wizard of Oz, right? The scarecrow needed a, whatever, okay. What's the scarecrow? Excuse me, a brain, a heart, okay, whatever. But the golem doesn't have any of those capacities. Yeah. Well, it is an interesting discussion. In fact, there is a related issue, which is not the question that you raised, about a ben pakua. Now, a ben pakua is when you shecht an animal and the animal is pregnant. So the halacha is that the fetus can actually be eaten without shechita, even if you, because it's considered to be shechted through the process of the mother. But not only that, there's a minority view, it's not a majority, that actually says the fetus is not fleshic, because since it was not born, it was not fleshic. And since it's not fleshic, even if it has later generations of children, all of those children, right, ad sofa olam, are not fleshic. So there was a fellow in Australia who wants to raise a herd of these, meaning that he wants to get himself a few of these, retrieve a few of these fetuses, and then he wants to create herds and herds and herds, because once you reproduce them, and then he will have not artificial meat, he will have actual meat. You can really have your cheeseburger, mamish. Real cheese, right? Real cheese and real meat. Now, according to halakha, number one, it's a minority view. Most opinions say it is fleshic. But number two, most rabbanim have refused to give, I think all rabbanim refused to give him a hashkacha. He's a religious person, because they say the confusion is much, much, much too great. You can't start having meat that you now say is halachically parif. It's very different than soy, because this is mamash from a cow. This is not like soy meat or, you know, artificial things. Okay. Now, all right, so now why am I bringing this in? All of this was just by way of introduction. But one of the things that Sefer Yetzirah does for every Rosh Chodesh is it connects every Rosh Chodesh to a letter of the Aleph Beis and to a human sense, like sight or hearing or the like. And it doesn't really explain what the Kesher is. It just makes the statement. And Rav Tzadok of Lublin, Rav Tzadok in the Pre-Tzadik, for every month, every Rosh Chodesh, he explains the relevant passage in Sefer Yetzirah. So I want to go over what Sefer Yetzirah says about the month of Cheshvan and how Rav Tzadok explains it. This is what Sefer Yetzirah, a letter of the Aleph Beis coupled with a Chush. Yeah, you'll see when I give you the statement, you'll understand what it is. For the month of Cheshvan, it says the following. Himlich os nun al hareach. Hashem made the letter Nun, king, together with the sense of smell, aroma. In fact, this is always going to be the formula. For every month, it'll say, Himlich, a certain letter, al some chush, right? So for Cheshvan, Himlich os Nun al hareach. So what, yeah. Well, sometimes it repeats. Sometimes it repeats the same chush, combines it with a different letter. Some months have two letters, right? Because you have, obviously you have 22 letters. You have more letters than months and more months than chushim, right? So you have to do combinations. So here's what Rav Tzadok says. What is the shaychut? What is the connection of nun to cheshvan? So he says very simply, we find that nun connotes the idea of nefila, falling down, slipping. This is a very famous Gemara, a very famous statement of Rabbi Yochanan in Maseches Brachos. Why is there no nun beginning a pasuk in Ashrei? Right, every verse of Ashrei, which is Tehillim Kuf Mem Hei 145, begins with Aleph Beis Gimel. Then Mem is Malchuscha Malchus Kol Olamim. Right, your kingdom is eternal. And then it says Somech Hashem. Hashem supports. There's no nun in Ashrei. So Rav Yochanan, well, there's a nun in Ashrei, but there's no nun that begins a pasuk in Ashrei. So Rav Yochanan explains, because nun connotes falling down. There's a pasuk in the Navi Amos. Nafla, talking about Golos. Nafla, she has fallen. Loi seisif kum, she will not get up again. Besulat Yisrael, the virgin of Israel. Nafla, very ominous, pessimistic, lack of hope. David HaMelech did not want to begin a pasuk in Ashrei with a message of despondency and hopelessness. And therefore, although he does mention nefilah in the next verse, but that's in the Samach verse that begins, Someich Hashem l'chol anoflim. Hashem supports all those who fall. He's not going to begin with nefilah, but Someich Hashem l'chol anoflim. This is what the Gemara says. By the way, the Gemara then goes on and says that in Eretz Yisrael, they were much more optimistic, even in that pasuk in Amos, because it all depends on where you put the comma. You can read it like I read it, Nafla, she has fallen, comma, lo sosif kum, she will not get up again. Right, that's ominous, that's disheartening. There's another way of reading it. Nafla lo sosif, she will not fall anymore. Kum, besulas Yisrael, arise. So it mentions that Bamarava in the west, Eretz Yisrael is always called in the Gemara the west, because Babylonia, which is Iraq, is to the east. Right, so Bamarava in the west, right? If you live in Israel, you have to be an optimist, right? And therefore, in Eretz Yisrael, they read it in a positive way, even though the Pshuto Shel Mikra is negative. But be it as it may, Nun has a connotation of Nefila. So says Rav Tzadok, when Sefer Yetzirah says that Os Nun has become the king of the month of Cheshvan, that suggests that Cheshvan has a bit of a negative tendency associated with it, and that is, it drags us down. There is going to be a natural feeling of Yerida when we enter Cheshvan. And the reason is very simple. We're leaving the most elevated, sanctified part of the year, really starting from Elul, right? Which are Yemei Ratzon, days of grace, days of mercy, the very famous mashal that Chabad uses, really from the Alter Rebbe, HaMelech Basadeh, right? The king is in the field for everybody to go and greet. And then we have Rosh Hashanah, the day of coronating Hashem. And then the Aseret Yemei Tshuva, where Hashem is close to us. And then the happiest day of Yom Kippur, of purity and forgiveness and reconciliation. And then the joy of Sukkos, which is the afterglow of Yom Kippur, where Hashem welcomes us into his home, culminating with Simchas Torah, Shemini Atzeres, Simchas Torah, which many have described as sukkah without the need of a sukkah, meaning to say, you feel the loving embrace of Hashem without the need of even a physical symbol. Right? A sukkah is a physical symbol that you're under a Kaddish Baruch Hu. But Shemini Atzeres, you can go back into your house and you still feel that it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Your house becomes a sukkah. By the way, that's why Shemini Atzeres is connected to the number 8. The 8th is very significant. The Maral says in many places that in terms of numbers, 7 represents the natural cycle of creation. Hashem made the world in 6 days, rested on Shabbos, and then starts over again. So 7 is the normal constraints of time and space. 8 is a level that is above the natural. It is connected to Olam Haba. It is not subject to space and time. That is why circumcision, that is why Brit Milah is on the 8th day. You know, there was a famous British historian, Arnold Toynbee, who was really, he was a notorious anti-Semite, but you know, but that doesn't cast aspersions on this idea, that he studied all of the ancient civilizations that existed, starting from the very earliest all the way through the Romans, all of the classical ancient civilizations, and it's a tremendous amount of data, and he was able to determine the various laws of history that caused some civilizations to rise and some to decline, and what makes them flourish and what makes them disintegrate. And this was a brilliant theory because he examined something 50 or 60 civilizations, and he was able to identify precise laws. But there was only one nation that didn't fit his paradigm, and that is the Jewish people. Because under his theory, right, his theory, which almost had a mathematical precision to it, there should not have been any Jews in the world at all. Because we didn't have a common language for most of our history. We didn't have a common territory. We were in Golos most of the time. So the idea of land and language, which were so important, we didn't have autonomy. So my theory is that's what made him an anti-Semite. Because if you spend 40 years of your life working out a theory, and everything fits except those Jews, you know, I would be mad. You know, I worked, my 40 years are a waste. So because of this, he concluded in a very famous remark that we have to look at the Jewish people as if they are a fossil that was simply discovered. Like, let's imagine you discovered some fossil of something that should have been extinct, It makes no sense. Now, he was accused of that being anti-Semitic, and Yaakov Herzog, Alef HaShalom, who was not the president, the president's brother, the son, both of them are were the sons of course, the Rav HaRashi. Yaakov Herzog, who was a big Talmud Chacham, actually, would go on college campus debates with Toynbee. This was called the famous Toynbee Herzog debate in the 1950s, the 1960s, in which they would debate, are Jews fossilized, people are not fossilized. But here is what I want to say. If Toynbee's point is, under the rules of history, there should not be a Jewish people, I would actually say he is correct. This is exactly what the Maharal is saying. The existence of a Jewish people cannot be explained by historical laws. It is a supernatural process that really is beyond any comparison to anything else. I mean, it's amazing how many civilizations have just disappeared. I mean, you would figure, you know, civilizations should stay on. There ought to be some people, right? There are no Romans in the world today, meaning that people live in Rome, but no one descended from the Romans. Civilizations do become totally extinct. And these were civilizations that were much more powerful than the Jewish people, much more influence, much more wealth, much more territory. They're all gone. And this little nation still here. And it's not that we're still here and we're in some cave in Pakistan, but, you know, Baruch Hashem, there's a lot of accomplishment, a lot of good things that are being done. And even from a secular perspective, the amazing things that Israel does, the amazing thing that the Jewish people do in really every field of endeavor. I see now that people are writing, you know, we have Hashem's promise to Avram. Va'varechecha mevarchecha. I will bless those who bless you. U'mikalelcha o'or. I will curse those who curse you. Really turns, I mean, you don't need proof that the Torah is emes, but it turns out to actually be true. People have pointed out, you know, Europe today is literally being destroyed by the Islamic scourge, whether it's Germany, France, to a lesser degree, England, Spain. It's like a cancer. And I saw an article by a non-Jewish writer, not a very, very respected journalist in Spain, who said, this is the consequence of things that happened 75 years ago. You didn't want the Jews. You thought that they were parasites. You thought that they were destructive. You got rid of the Jews. So Hashem says, okay, I'll give you the Muslims. See which you like better. Which would you rather have? Every country that Jews were in, and again, this is not even I don't even have to describe this in religious terms. They always made the society better in some way or not. Right? Every society was improved because Jews were in it. And now we have a replacement, so to speak, where every society they go into just gets destroyed. Yeah. Yeah, good luck. That's right. So the truth of the matter is that, I mean, I remember, you know, I took one trip to Poland with the Darchibina Seminary a few years ago. The only time, again, it was a very very moving trip. I wasn't sure. And people are debating, should you go? You're giving money to whatever. But I remember at some point, we were at Auschwitz, and a woman, a very white hair, very old woman, came up to me. And she started crying, sobbing and talking in Polish. I had no idea what she was saying, but we had a guide, a Polish guide, who basically said that she was a non-Jewish woman and her parents had sheltered Jews and they died at Auschwitz. They were sent against and they died at Auschwitz. And she comes to Auschwitz also to tell Jews and also to do her own avelis. But she gave a whole little drasha, so to speak, that since the Jews were taken away, there was no bracha, there was no blessing. There was no blessing on the land. Yeah, is the microphone on? Let me see. Are we on? Yeah. Okay, I'm not sure. The microphone for some reason is not is not working that well, although it's on. So, but she said she was makir that since the Jews left, the bracha was taken away in so many ways. Okay, but be it as it may, I'm describing the trajectory of the Chagim, right? Rosh Hashanah, where we make Hashem the king, Yom Kippur, the day of forgiveness and reconciliation, Sukkos, the simcha of Hashem welcoming us into his home, Simchas Torah, Me'ein Olam Haba, where even in the physical home we see Hashem. So we're going up, 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 higher and higher and higher. And then, just like, you know, you're running a marathon, 26 miles, and then you stop all of a sudden. What's next? What happens now? Ordinary life. Go back to the routine. So Rav Tzadok says, this is what Sefer Yetzirah means. When Sefer Yetzirah says that in Cheshvan, there will be a hergesh, there will be a feeling of nefilah, falling down. A person can lose a lot of that kedusha. Yeah. That's very true. That's very true. It was a month of destruction. That's right. That would be connected to it. Because when there's spiritual nefilah, there's physical nefilah. So, how do you protect yourself from that? So Rav Tzadok says, the antidote is reyach. What is reyach? He says, reyach is what is left when the physical thing is no longer here. Let's imagine you had a big roast chicken or a barbecue, right? And all the meat got finished, or everything was taken out of the room. So there's no more chicken left. But there might be a nice aroma that can remind you of the chicken. Those of you who are literary, if you ever read, which I have not, Marcel Proust's Remembrance of Things Past, which is, I think, the biggest novel. Well, it was written in French, but it's, I don't know, 2,000 pages, gigantic novel. It begins, the whole story begins with someone smelling something that triggered a certain memory that reconnected him to his past. And therefore, Cheshvan does not have the mamashut. It does not have the reality of the Chagim. But there is a reyach in Cheshvan that still connects us, that we think, we remember, we relive, and this gives us chizuk to go on. But we could go a little further with this, and in many ways, one might say, maybe with a little exaggeration, that Cheshvan is the most important month of the year. In its very ordinariness, it is Cheshvan that is the test of whether we truly have been transformed by the Yomim Noraim, or if it was just a superficial exercise. The Chazon Ish used to give a mashal, very, very nice mashal. He says, if you put a pot on a fire, and the pot bubbles over, it overflows, and you're asked, how full was this pot? You really don't know, because even if it's a half empty, when it's on a fire, it'll overflow. The only way you could tell how full a pot really is when it's off the fire. Then I can see, is it full? Is it half empty? So, when a person is connected to the fire of hislavos, of enthusiasm, of avoda, of chagim, and a person is inspired, that does not necessarily reflect the internal changes that are within them. Because even if they really didn't do any of that work, they get caught up. We get caught up in the simcha, in the hislalus, in the aliyah of a chag. But the real test of whether we've been changed, whether we've been transformed, is when you no longer have the special occasions. How are you going to conduct your life? Will it be a little different? And that's why I think the Friedek Rebbe of Chabad once asked his father, the Rebbe Rashab, and after Simchas Torah, he says, so what do we do now? What's our avodah now? You know, Rosh Hashanah, Aseret Yemei Tshuva, Yom Kippur, Sukkos, Simchas Torah, all of it's over. What do we do now? And his father said, now is the time to really do tshuva. Which means, in a funny way, the Yomim Naran were so caught up in the actual observance of the Chagim that perhaps we didn't give a lot of thought about the tangible ways that we're going to try to make our life better and different. And it is precisely the confrontation with the ordinary that is the test of whether the Yomim Noraim, the days of awe, have transformed us. So automatically, you know, some people might say, oh, Baruch Hashem, Cheshvan is such a relief, there's no Yomim Tovim. But really it's the opposite. HaKadosh Baruch Hu B'davka wanted us to have a period where actually every day is special, and of course Shabbos Kodesh is still the greatest of all of the Chagim, but no Yom Tov, so to speak, so that we will now be capable of applying the elevation of the Yomim Noraim into our ordinary life. In this connection, you know, on the Avodah of Yom Kippur, the service of Yom Kippur that was performed by the Kohen Gadol. So you'll remember that the Kohen Gadol did everything. The Kohen Gadol had two uniforms on Yom Kippur. He had his regular uniform with the breastplate and everything else, and that uniform had gold threads in it. So that's called Big Day Zahav. Big Day Zahav, the golden garments, are his ordinary uniform. But when he went into the Kodesh HaKadoshim to bring the incense, he is not allowed to wear that golden uniform because the gold is connected to the Chet HaEgel. And when he is seeking mercy for the Jewish people in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, we have a klal, Ein Kategor Nasa Sanegor, that means the prosecutor, the Chet HaEgel, should not be used to seek defense. So when he went into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, he would switch to a pure white linen garment without any gold. Now the Kohen Gadol changed his garments 5 times because he would go back and forth. When he did Avoda outside of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, he wore Big Day Zahav. When he did Avoda in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, he wore Big Day Lavan. And based on the very detailed choreography of the Seder Avoda, so he started off the day with Big Day Zahav, that's where he brought the daily offering. Then he did Big Day Lavan with the Ketores. Then he would put on Zahav for other korbanos that were outside of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Then he put on Lavan. Then he put on Zahav. Right? So it's 5 acts. Zahav, Lavan, Zahav, Lavan, Zahav. And by that time, Yom Kippur was over and he was finished. Now, Chazal teach us that every single time he would switch garments, he would go to the mikveh in between. So he went to the mikveh 5 times on Yom Kippur. Although we normally don't even wash anything on Yom Kippur, but this is a mitzvah, this is a chiyuv, and therefore he went to the mikveh 5 times on Yom Kippur. Now here's the question. We understand that mikveh obviously has very powerful symbolic meanings. It purifies you, it sanctifies you, it elevates you. It prepares you for Kedusha, even the woman going every month. That is actually also what mikveh represents. So I understand when you go from gold to white, you're about to enter the Kodesh HaKadoshim. You need intense spiritual preparation. So I understand why the Kohen Gadol would have to go to the mikveh when he's going from the lower holiness to a higher holiness. He has to prepare himself. But when he's leaving the Kodesh HaKadoshim and he's taking off the white garments and he's going to do the daily sacrifices, that's a lower level of sanctity. Why would he have to go to the mikveh when he leaves the Kodesh HaKadoshim? He's going from the higher level to the lower level. And the answer is, we make a mistake about what is higher and what is lower. It is true that the Kodesh HaKadoshim is a higher level. But to take the Kodesh HaKadoshim and bring it into everyday life is even a higher level than that. And the Kohen Gadol is now confronting the challenge of taking the pinnacle of holiness that he experienced and bringing it into his daily life and into the daily life of Klal Yisrael. Now, of course, we know that many of the Kohanim Gedolim of the Bayit Sheni were very, very far from tzaddikim, and I'm not suggesting that most of the time they achieved this. But that's really besides the point, because we're not focusing so much on whether any individual Kohen Gadol was able to achieve this. We're focusing on what is the idea that the Torah is communicating by creating these multiple levels of immersion. And the answer is that you immerse when you go from lower to higher, but when you take the higher into the lower, that is even a greater level of Kedusha, for which you need Tevila as well. And therefore, we could say the whole month of Tishrei is like being in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. And the month of Cheshvan is leaving the Kodesh HaKadoshim. But it is a higher level of Kedusha that we take that Kedusha with us and we bring it out. Like the Chazon Ish said, when you're not on the fire, to still be full, you really have to be full, right? The pot has to be full when it's not on the fire. In this connection, it's very, very interesting that the Meshech Chochmah says, in Parshas Hazinu, Moshe Rabbeinu said, and many people say this before Shmoneh Esrei, for Mincha and Musaf at least, the verse, Ki Shem Hashem Ekra, when I call upon the name of Hashem, Moshe saying this to Bnei Yisrael, Havu Godel Lelokeinu, you shall ascribe greatness to our God. Right? Moshe Rabbeinu says, when I describe what Hashem did, you should give greatness and shevach to Hashem. But note that there are two names of God that are being used. Ki Shem Hashem Ekra. Hashem is Yudke Vavke. That's the name of God we don't pronounce. Give greatness Elokeinu. Elokeinu is Elokim. Now, what is the difference between Shem Havaya and Shem Elokim? Now, there are actually several differences. The most familiar difference that people know is Havaya is Rachamim, Elokim is Din. But there's actually a more basic difference. Havaya, Shem Havaya, Yudke Vavke, is when Hashem reveals himself above the natural ways, a supernatural, transcendent, miraculous revelation of Hashem that is above the laws of nature, is Shem Havaya. Elokim is when Hashem operates within the framework and laws of nature. In fact, it's been pointed out by many Mekubalim, Elokim is Begematria 86, and Hateva, you have to use the hay for this, Hateva, nature, is also Begematria 86. Right? So that Elokim is God running the world through the normal laws of nature. So when I drop a pen and it goes down because of gravity, it is Elokim that is creating that hanhaga. If I were to let go and the thing would fly up somehow, that would be Shem Havaya. So the difference between Moshe Rabbeinu and all the later generations was that when Moshe Rabbeinu was Manig Am Yisrael in the desert, the Hanhaga, the leadership, the way Hashem dealt with us, was the supernatural, miraculous Shem Havaya. There was man that came down from the sky, Anonei HaKavod, clouds of glory, water, Shem Havaya. Now keep in mind that the Shem Havaya can have a downside as well, because when you're living in a world of supernatural revelation, then every little aveira could cause a supernatural response. Right? In other words, b'derech hateva, a person does an aveira, the house is not going to fall down on him. Yes, in Olam Haba, there's schar v'onesh, but b'derech hateva, people get away with things, but in the short term. But when you live the hanhaga of Hashem being open and revealed, then every misstep will have an immediate miraculous response. Right? That's kind of, you might call it, the downside. So Moshe Rabbeinu brought down into the world the Shem Havaya. But what's going to happen? We're going to come to Eretz Yisrael and Moshe's going to die, and Yeshua's going to take over. Well, there's not going to be man. We're going to have to plant. We're going to have an army. We're going to have businesses. We're going to have lawyers and doctors and accountants. Under those circumstances, there are two dangers. One is a danger that we despair, that we think our situation is so impossible. But the other danger is the opposite. We attribute our successes to us. The Torah warns us again and again, when you come into the land and you will be successful, be very, very careful. V'ram levavecha, your heart will get high and mighty. V'shachachta es Hashem Elokecha, you will forget Hashem. V'amarta, and you will say, Kochi v'yotzim yodi, it is my strength and the might of my hands. Asali es kol achayel hazeh, that accomplished all of this great strength. So Moshe Rabbeinu is telling them the following. Ki shem Hashem ekra. When I remind you of all of the things you experienced through the Shem Havaya, the open miracles, the man, the be'er, the Anonei HaKavod, Kriyas Yamsuf, the Makos in Mitzrayim, Matan Torah, I will be reminding you of what you saw from the Shem Havaya. But what's the purpose? Havu Godel Lelokeinu. That when you experience, no longer do you experience the Shem Havaya, but you experience the normal operations that come through Elohim, but know that they too come from Hashem. Meaning the memory of the Shem Havaya should remind you that even when there's concealment, and even when there's normalcy, and even when there appears to just be nature, it is in fact Elohim, Hashem, that is doing it all. And he says, the Meshech Chachma says, that this is the meaning. When, but right at the end of Yom Kippur, we said seven times, Hashem Hu Elokim. Now, what is that taken from? If you remember, this is a great miracle. Eliyahu on Mount Carmel in Haifa, right? So the prophets of the Baal, Avodah Zarah, they built their altar, and Eliyahu built an altar, and they called to the Baal, and Eliyahu called to Hashem. And a miracle came, and a fire came from heaven and consumed the korban of Hashem, for Hashem. Actually, the truth of the matter is, what Eliyahu HaNavi did was something that was actually forbidden at the time, because there was a Beis HaMikdash. And when there's a Beis HaMikdash, you're not allowed to bring korbanos outside of the Beis HaMikdash. And this is a classic example of what is called Hora'at Sha'ah. That is a temporary emergency basis. A Navi is permitted to violate the halacha. If Eliyahu Navi would have said, there's a new halacha, you can bring korbanos outside of the Beis HaMikdash, that would have made him a Navi Sheker, and we would not be allowed to believe him. But if it's a one-time thing, question is how many times? What if it's more than one? Okay, but at least if it's a one-time thing, it's a Rad Shah. So what happened was, all of the idolaters fell on their faces, and they said, Hashem Hu Elokim. So the Meshech Chachma says, this is exactly what it means. Meaning, we were zocha to see the Havaya. It's a supernatural miracle. From this we understand that even when Hashem is concealed, there is Elokim. There is God that is running the world. Hashem Hu Elokim. In fact, the Ramban says this in several places, that the reason why a miracle is called a nes. Now the word nes actually means a banner, a flag. Like we say, saw nes lekabetz galiyosena, lift up a banner so that the exiles will be ingathered. So the Ramban says, because a flag is there to get your attention, you should look where the flag is. So too, Hashem does supernatural miracles so we will realize that He is running the world. But he's not only running the world when he is doing supernatural miracles. He's running the world all the time, but we don't notice it. So every once in a while, he needs to get our attention, so to speak. And that's the idea of a nes. So to take this Meshech Chochma, I would just add that the same way that from the supernatural manifestations of God, you come to appreciate that Hashem is in your life, even in the ordinary. That's also true for the Kedusha that we experience. From the Yomim Noraim, there's kind of a Shem Havaya aspect, meaning you feel connected to Hashem because of the unique holiness of those days. But the truth of the matter is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is with us every single moment of the year. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is accessible every moment of the year. He yearns for a relationship with us. He wants to hear our tefillas. He wants us to love him and we to love him and he to love us. But it's in a much more of a concealed way. And therefore the idea is Hashem Hu Elokim, when you experience Hashem's love in an open way, it's designed to make you remember that even when all of that goes away, the reality still is that Hashem is here, Hashem is yearning for us, Hashem wants to have a relationship with us, and Hashem is very hospitable in the sense that if he is welcome, wherever he is welcomed is where he will come. So in many ways, this is the great, great importance of the month of Cheshvan. I'll just end with one quick little story. They tell the story about a Russian peasant who somehow converted to Judaism in a Hasidic community. Again, I'm not going to get into the halachas of how he did it. This is a story. And it was a very good community for him because virtually every 2 weeks they had a big party with a lot of drinking and they had Shabbos in between also. So he converted at a very nice time of the year. He converted right before Rosh Chodesh Shvat. So it was wonderful. Rosh Chodesh Shvat, big party. Tu B'Shvat, big party. Rosh Chodesh Adar, big party. Purim, big party. Rosh Chodesh Nisan, big party. Pesach, you know, big party. Baruch Hashem, everything's great. So he tells his friend Ivan, he says, Ivan, you got to join this religion. This is the greatest religion. You know, eat, drink, sing. And then even between, there's Shabbos, every Shabbos. It's wonderful, wonderful. You can't beat it. So Ivan, took a while for Ivan to convert. So Ivan finally converts shortly before Rosh Chodesh Tammuz. So Rosh Chodesh Tammuz, it's kind of a different rhythm in the calendar. Because Rosh Chodesh Tammuz already, they didn't make a big simcha, it's approaching the 3 weeks, and then you have Shiva Zarba Tammuz, and then the 9 days. So he has this stretch where, you know, everything's going wrong. You know, no drinking, no meat, no laundry, no haircuts, no weddings, no music. He says, everything is muted, everything. And then fast days, you know, Shiva Zarba Tammuz, Tisha B'Av fasting. So he goes over to his friend and he says, you know, I don't know, you promised me we would have parties and rejoicing all the time. All I have is every single day there's some new restriction that I'm hearing about. What's going on? So his friend scratches his head and says, I don't know. Ever since you joined, things have been going downhill. Now, the truth of the matter is, we understand, though, right? Every person understands that there's a rhythm in the Jewish calendar. And Koheles summarized it very well. La kol zman. Everything has its time. Times of sadness, times of grieving, times of joy, times of birth, times of bereavement. A person has to understand that everything has its purpose. Everything has its role. Everything is part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's revelation into the world, even if we don't fully understand it. Now, what's interesting is that this is not only true for the whole year. This is true for the month of Tishrei itself. Because if you think about it, the month of Tishrei itself has many, many different types of moods that are somewhat contradictory to each other, right? We have the seriousness and somberness of Rosh Hashanah, coupled with the fact that Rosh Hashanah itself was also a Yom Tov, right? Even around Rosh Hashanah itself, you have these two moods. You have Nisan Tokef, who will live, who will die, who will have peace, who will have anxieties. And then we have Yom Kippur. And then we have the joy of Sukkot, and then the unrestrained Simcha of Simchas Torah. It's almost like we're manic depressive. We're going back and forth. But the truth of the matter is, because the month of Tishrei is the beginning of the year, it creates a template, it creates kind of a foundation to be able to serve Hashem with all of your emotions and all of the matzavim. Because in the course of a year, there will be different matzavim that a person faces. There will be moments of joy where the emotion you will have is gratitude. And there might be, hopefully not, but there might be moments of sadness or fear, where there might be a pacha. And Hashem wants us to experience all of these emotions at the very beginning of the year, so we will have the tools to be able to serve Hashem as a whole person, as all of these different things happen to us in the course of the year. You see, there are people who are, they connect more to the happy parts of Judaism than to the introspective parts. And there are people who are the other way around, actually. I mean, this is a very funny thing to say, but I've heard from more than one person that they enjoy Tisha B'Av more than Purim. Now, what do we mean? We don't mean enjoy Tisha B'Av, but they feel very close to Hashem, that they could think about Golos and Geula, and they prefer the quiet, introspective idea than the, dancing on tables and the like. But the truth of the matter is, every person has to be able to serve Hashem with all of those different emotions. We have to serve Hashem with introspection and cheshbon nefesh, and we have to serve Hashem b'simcha. Otherwise, you're just doing your natural thing. Just to do what comes naturally, whichever way it is not really serving Hashem. That's, in fact, this is a long, much longer talk than we have time for. I mean, this is why the idea of nisayon, each of the avos, has to go through something that is against their nature. Avram, whose nature is chesed, his nisayon is to do something that looks cruel. Yaakov, whose midah is emes, has to engage in deception and lying. Okay, what does Yitzchak do? That's all, again, I'll talk for another time. But the idea is, because when you only serve Hashem by what comes naturally to you, you're not really serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So, in a sense, therefore, Tishrei is to give you an encapsulation of the whole year. In fact, there's an old minhag, I think the Yekkis have it in Washington Heights, I haven't seen it here, that the last Kaddish after Musaf of Simchas Torah, the end, which in Chutz Lawrence would be the day after, the ninth day, they combine Nigunim for every single Kaddish of the whole year. Of course, that assumes that you have a special Nigun. Again, most shuls don't even have a special Nigun, but if you're in Washington Heights, a Yeki, you have a Nigun for Pesach, for Sukkot, for Shavuot. So every single thing is there, because in a sense, the Yom Ha'Nirayim is a encapsulation of the totality of the experiences of a Jewish life. So wish you all a wonderful, wonderful year, and we'll see you next week. Yep. Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. Again, the share today is sponsored by Mel and Pessy Krauss David, and we all wish Mel a refuah shleima, Menachem Mendel, Ben Tova Rivka, and we're very, very grateful for all the support that he gives for us.